baby, I just can't get right. Well, I hate to leave you, baby. Don't mean maybe, because I love you so. Good night, sweetheart. Well, it's time to go. Good night, sweetheart. Well, it's time to go. I hate to leave you, I really must say. Oh, good night, sweetheart. Good night. Your mother, oh, and your father, don't like it if I stay here too long. One kiss in the dark, and I'll be going. You know I hate to go. Good night, sweetheart. Well, it's time to go. Good night, sweetheart. Well, it's time to go. I hate to leave you, I really must say. Oh, good night, sweetheart. Good
good afternoon to all of our loyal listeners at WHFR. This is the new WHFR Journal. I am Susan Morell, and I'm sitting in for Jay Cornick today. And he is out and about in the wonderful, hopefully sunshine, of Austin, Texas. And we hope he's having a really good time. He deserves it because he works so very hard when he's here at WHFR, keeping the radio station together as the station advisor. And I'm joined today in the studio by Ned Apigian. Hello, Ned.
Hi.
Long time no see.
Well, you went away, then you came back.
Yes, I did. And
I sometimes co-host with Jay, too.
Yes, you do. Ned is one of our political authorities here in the city of Dearborn, in Dearborn Heights. And Ned has been involved in local politics for how many years now, Ned?
I don't know, 6, 7, 8. All I know is I keep losing when I win.
Well, I voted for you.
Thank God somebody did.
You know, I think you're a very good candidate, yeah. And you're very knowledgeable, and you really have a lot to offer.
Yeah. Opinions are cheap, thank God. They don't cost any money.
Opinions are cheap.
Today we'll have a lot of opinions about a couple things we're seeing in the newspaper.
Yes.
Okay, what are we going to begin with that's most interesting that's affecting our lives today?
Well, I think you have an article there from, which paper is that from?
Well, actually, both our local newspapers, which are the Press and Guide and the Times Herald, and we're going to talk a little bit about the HUD grant of $2.4 million to fight foreclosures in the city. And I had the opportunity today to visit Frank Bewick, whom we always talk about on the program. So when I went this morning to pick up my paper, I made it my point to talk to Frank and remind him to listen, since we invariably always bring up his name. And so I had the opportunity to interrupt him, and he turned around from his computer and We said hi, and I said, be sure to listen. We're going to read your article. The article is covered not more than once, but here goes.
Okay.
The first thing in the press and guide, they
and
have
a... And that's from which, what date?
Today, Wednesday the 15th, and yes, both newspapers. From the Press and Guide, which I'm not going to read from, but I just want to bring to your attention, they have an interesting, I don't know what you would call. What do we call these things? I've forgotten. My old age, cartoon.
Viewpoint and cartoons.
Viewpoint,
and
cartoon.
Opinion pieces.
Opinion pieces that's in the form of a picture. So, for lack of a better word, it's a cartoon. It shows the mayor holding... a little notice saying that the city of Dearborn Heights is going to get $2.43 million in HUD neighborhood stabilization funds for Dearborn. Now we're going to find out what that means. And then there's a nice lady looking at him as he's bewildered, it looks here. He should be happy instead of being bewildered. It's good to finally see some federal funds for our street, says the lady. And with all the talk about federal funds for Wall Street. So they captivated this article, this story, with this photograph, this picture, it's not a photograph. But we're going to read from Mr. Bewick's article, and hopefully those of you who don't have the newspaper are going to learn something more about this. Well, here, this article is by Patrick Pepper, and it says, as part of the federal housing grant, city officials will have an additional $2.4 million to combat the myriad problems of the ongoing foreclosure crisis. The money will be used to supplement the $750,000 already used as part of the city's multifaceted neighborhood stabilization program initiated last year. The neighborhood stabilization program combines Operation Eyesore, an initiative begun in 1960 to curb blight, and a new land bank initiative targeting abandoned or foreclosed houses the city deems unappealing to modern buyers. Those houses include Depression area garage houses and other small footprint structures. It also utilizes the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development Dollar Home Program, which offers the cities the chance to purchase foreclosed properties for only a dollar with the intent of selling them to low or moderate income families. This is me, presumably after they've been fixed. But with the federal money now in hand, city officials will be able to extend their efforts beyond just obsolete or blighted homes. The HUD funds can be used to rehabilitate houses, assist in rent, help in financing for home buyers, or offer builders loans to remodel houses that would be repayable upon selling. I guess my question is answered. This is very important, the article continues, in terms of battling foreclosures, said Nick Siraski, coordinator of the Neighborhood Stabilization Program. It allows us to consider other areas that we didn't allocate funds to, and it eases the financial burden on the city. The grant targets individuals whose families make up to 120% of the $48,900 annual median income for the area, with adjustments considered for the size of a family, something that could be that could definitely benefit 7 in 10 residents. On Tuesday, Siraski went to a training seminar in Columbus so that he could figure out how to utilize this program. So, Susan, what do we... Isn't this a wonderful thing? Because many, I know, I've been to council meetings in Dearborn Heights. The question of the foreclosed home has been brought up many times. And the cities, I said, well, what do you expect us to do? We don't have the money to purchase these things and fix them.
Well, right, this but let me ask a question here, Ned. How does HUD work to help consumers, people who want to buy a house? How does that work? Do you know?
Well, usually they either, in the old days, like I'm on the board of directors of a senior citizens building, HUD actually gave the money for the mortgage. In most instances, they guarantee mortgages.
So what does a consumer do? They apply to HUD?
Well, usually in this case, this the two processes are unrelated in that what usually happens is in the old, let's say the old days, if you went and got a HUD mortgage, you went to a bank and they guaranteed the mortgage with the bank. The money
HUD guaranteed it with the bank.
They guaranteed the mortgage. In this case, what's happening is the government is giving the city of Dearborn a grant, which means a gift.
And
so they're actually
giving
them money, and the city is utilizing it in its existing program, as the article defines, the stabilization program. This is a wonderful thing. That would answer the question at the meetings when people are complaining about the foreclosed homes.
But what is the city going to do? Buy the houses with the HUD money?
Well, whatever it said here, it described those very small Depression-era garage homes. And,
right.
And the article pretty well describes how they want to handle it.
Okay, well
it was news to me.
It's a good thing.
I think it's something Dearborn should be happy about.
Yes.
Now, the next question is, the people in Dearborn Heights will say, where do we get ours?
Well, I think everybody is saying, where do we get ours?
But you got to wait in line, that's all.
There's another article here in the Times-Herald for this past Wednesday, October 15th. And this is an article about Comcast. And I think most people these days have some type of cable, and Comcast is my provider. Do you have Comcast?
Yes, I have Comcast as well.
And so there was a ruling in a lawsuit against Comcast.
Wonderful. Is my monthly charge going to come down?
That was from the city of Dearborn. A federal judge's recent ruling supports the city's continuing efforts to keep public access channels readily available and without additional expense to Comcast cable TV customers. And I like that part, without additional expense. The city's lawsuit will continue, with the judge referring the key issues to the Federal Communications Commission. And the judge described the FCC as the expert on cable TV issues. I agree. Comcast, and here's the gist of what Comcast has to do at this point. Comcast must keep the PEG channels in their current location in the channel lineup so that they are easy for customers to find. I agree.
Is that the 12 and 16 or 18, whatever?
Well, those are the public educational channels regarding government access channels in education.
Oh, they're not the ones that cover, those are not the ones that cover the, you know, council hearings.
Yes, yes.
The government.
Yes. And Comcast must keep providing those channels in analog format so that customers do not have to buy or rent additional equipment to view them in digital format. That also is a good thing.
Is that what the judge ruled?
This is what the judge ruled. And to be fair, here's what Comcast offered. The Comcast offered to provide a digital converter box to its customers free of charge for 1 year. However, most households would require more than one converter box because most households have more than one cable television, and they have more than one viewer watching different shows at different times.
Isn't the government going to provide to people that can't afford?
Well, this is a separate issue, and
$40.
And Comcast made no commitment past 1 year for the box. So, in other words, after the year is up, then you'd have to pay. So the city has argued that the change to digital would amount to a $4 per month increase for Comcast customers. We don't want an increase. So this is
why the, is that?
Well, we don't want an increase.
Is that what they're saying?
Yeah, well, that's what that's what Comcast said. You know, it would have amounted to a $4 per month increase for Comcast customers. And the city also argued, this is the city of Dearborn, argues that Comcast is required to provide PEG channels on its basic tier, the lowest cost service for the customers.
Right.
I agree. Because otherwise, if they put it on another tier...
Aren't they now on their lowest tier?
Yeah, well, they wanted to move it. You know, they move, they're moving things around all the time.
Right.
So that is the situation. The city of Dearborn protected us consumers against Comcast.
But and not me and you. We live in Dearborn Heights.
Well, we're still protected. Yeah, we're still protected. And I'm very happy with the ruling. I'm very happy.
This is one thing I don't understand. It just doesn't make any sense. The whole idea was for these people to do away with the analog and work in digital.
Yeah, but that's coming later, and that's not...
That's happening in February.
Well, that's a separate issue, and we'll get to that issue later. That's not our, that's not one of our issues today. We'll get to that.
I can't imagine Comcast providing an analog for a couple of channels and then... doing digital. I don't know how you'd solve that problem.
Well,
but I can't
when Jay
solve
gets
everything.
Back, when Jay gets back, he'll we'll answer that question.
Well, one thing is for sure, we're a quarter away through the program.
Yes.
And we should be identifying ourselves. You are listening to none other than the Henry Ford Community College radio station, WHFR at 89.3 on your FM dial, and we are here making waves, and you are listening to the new WHFR Journal, and your host today is Susan Garrett. She's back.
Susan Morrell.
Susan Morrell, and she's back on her job as the news director.
Yes.
And I'm here just to help out when everybody needs some help, and I am Ned Apikian, of course.
Yes. Now, and if you want to listen online, it's whfr.fm from anywhere in the
world
on the internet. And we're podcasting the new WHFR Journal, too, as well as other shows.
Yeah, we got to learn how to use that podcast.
Yes, we are.
Thank God.
So,
next topic.
What? We had a presidential
debate
this past week with Obama and McCain.
Mm-hmm.
And what are your thoughts?
Well, it's, you know what they say, perception is in the eye of the beholder. That's what I think. I think people that are supporting one or the other believe the one he's supporting did well. My own opinion is slightly different. I thought that, you know, everybody says that Obama won the three debates, and perhaps he did, however you measure. My major concern about all three of them was that Mr. McCain's continued aggressiveness and facial features and tone of his voice, to me, I realize he needs to be aggressive, is completely not doing him any good. I don't understand why he decided to do that. It's not effective. And then, Mr. Obama never seems to follow up and attack him.
Well, that's kind of been Obama's persona since he started debating, when he was even debating Hillary. He keeps a cool head. He's very cool under pressure, and he's very low-key. That's his style.
Yeah.
He seems to be very, very composed, and I think that is a very good trait to have as a president. However, McCain has been known for many years for his temper, and we've heard this about him for many years, that he does have a bad temper. And I think we kind of saw that come out in this last debate. His temper came out and flared up a little bit more.
I thought in the first one, I was telling my wife that I think the guy kicked him, threw him to the ground, spat on him, called him names, and I thought he beat him up, was my...
Who beat who up?
That McCain beat Obama up. He just attacked him, knocked him down, and every time he had an opportunity, even in this most recent one, to say... The thing that struck me the most was when the question was raised, do you think your running mate could be president? Mm-hmm. And all he had to say for Joe Biden was that, you know, and he said it, yes. And Joe Biden has 35 years experience in government, especially in foreign affairs and on the Judicial Committee, and left it at that. And then he had to denigrate the guy after he said he was there for six terms. I don't think that helped him. He didn't have to go into it. I think
who denigrated Biden?
McCain. He took the opportunity to slam Joe Biden in the question of, is the other guy's running mate capable? Now, look what Obama did. He didn't say anything negative about Sarah Palin at all.
Well, it's a different strategy, and I think a lot of the pundits...
And that woman is not even qualified to be on a ticket, if
you
ask me.
A lot of the pundits...
But he didn't say anything negative.
He doesn't have to because he's ahead. But a lot of the pundits
are advising... Or everybody knows Sarah Palin does not qualify. I don't know.
A lot of the pundits are giving McCain advice and telling him to attack them, and I've heard them do that.
I think it's his natural personality as well.
Well, they say he does have a temper, and I think he proved that in the last debate. However, he and Obama... were at a special occasion dinner last night, and it was a comedy. They exchanged a comedy.
A roast.
And
the
I could
Alfred
see,
E. Smith comedy roast.
Yes, and I could see that McCain has a very good sense of humor.
Actually, he did a better job than
Obama. McCain is really funny.
Yeah.
He has a great sense of humor, so I got a kick out of that. Obama didn't do as well in that.
But he kind of promoted himself nicely, I thought, in his summation. But one thing is for sure, this based on what I've seen, I don't know that I'd want to see Mr. McCain in a negotiation with some foreign power with his attitude.
Well, that's a good point. And
I thought about that. I said, this is not the guy you want to have talking to somebody and trying to make a deal. He's liable to insult you.
A very short fuse.
Very short fuse.
You know, you have to really... I like Obama's strategy when he's talking about negotiating with people and talking to them, because you have to start out from a nice vantage point.
Yeah, you don't usually beat a person and then talk to him later.
Yeah, don't come in beating him up with the gloves on. You know, that's not a good strategy. So, I think the consensus is that Obama won the debate again, and so I think he's very cool under pressure. So that's probably what we would find very appealing in a president.
Well,
right?
Like I said, it's always in the eye of the supporter. What really amazes me, we've talked about this before, the public in general. I happened to speak to a Ford Motor retired executive who I thought was a Republican in our conversation. I was corrected. He said something that I've always said. Is I do not understand how the average person makes electoral decisions that are not in their financial interests. It amazes me that the difference between the two parties, whether they're very similar or not, but when one proclaims and shows by its attitude that they need to give more money, more tax breaks to major corporations and to multimillionaires, because when these people, these successful entities, are treated well, then their success trickles down to you. This is something that they keep talking about, but has never happened. It trickled down on you, all right, but it's not money that's trickling down on you.
It's a mudslide.
I cannot believe that you would think in this financial market, which we're going to talk about a little later, that virtually almost half the people, 45% or 40%, still think that the the practices and policies of the party in power, forget the individuals, are the things that need to be supported based on what's happened to you in the last 7.5 years.
Let's hope that doesn't happen, but it's very, very, very important to vote. And there's an article in the Press and Guide, again from October 15th, in the College Corner, and this is by Jody Rampala. And she says here, Henry Ford Community College has received a grant to help recruit student poll workers.
That's great.
To work at the polls. And Henry Ford Community College, HFCC, has received a $32,167 grant called Help America Vote. And it's a grant from the U.S. Elections Assistance Commission. And they've partnered with the cities of Dearborn and Dearborn Heights.
Thank God.
To train college students to participate as poll workers in the 2008 general election on November 4th. It's coming right up in a few weeks. Don't forget to vote, people.
We need people to drive people to the polls. I don't know what those people are going to do standing at the polling place.
Okay, well,
the problem is you need more machines, so your line is smaller.
And let me go on with this article. It says, Henry Ford Community College students chosen to work at the polls in November elections will help with the setup of election equipment, process voters, offer instructions, verify voted ballots, complete the poll book, and help with the closing of the polls. Students will also attend a city training session and 2 mandatory HFCC seminars. I think it's a great program. Both Arabic and English-speaking students were recruited through HFCC political science classes, student clubs, information tables, and Henry Ford Community College radio station, WHFR.
That's us.
89.3 FM.
We've been promoting it.
And the HFCC website, hfcc.edu. And if you want more information on the Help America Vote grant, please call 313-845-6383. Ned, do you help out at polling?
Actually, I've been a candidate. I've never...
Okay, so you're a candidate, so you can't do it.
Actually, I'll tell you what the thing... The thing, it pays about $100 a day. And I was going to ask you this question. Are these kids being paid? They must be being paid.
Well, I presume they are.
Because usually when you go to the polls, you'll see the crew of senior citizens there working. Those people have a little bit of instruction a week or so before.
Right.
And they're working from like 6 to 7 to 8. They get about $100 each that are working. And so I would think that this $32,000, a greater percentage of it has to do with giving these students a chance to part, because they'd be working right along with those other people.
Well, and that's true.
And but the problem in elections is, as you've seen from other I've never seen it where I vote, that the district which the party in power puts 2 machines, knowing that most of the voters are going to be voting Democratic as opposed to Republican, and therefore the lines are long, people get exasperated, and they leave. The big problem by working at the polls is having enough machines, and always the more help you have, but that's the real issue.
And
if you've got a long ballot and everybody doesn't have time to read it beforehand, doesn't come prepared, they could be in there for 15 minutes.
And let's hope that the ballots and the machines actually are counting the votes accurately, because there is a lot of criticism about that. There is a lot of concern from the last election that the votes were not being counted correctly. So that is a huge, huge issue, and I'm sure we'll get into that as we get closer to the election. But just to let you know, you are listening to WHFR Dearborn 89.3 on your FM dial. I am Susan Burrell, sitting in for Jay Kornick, and Ned Pagan is here offering his expertise on politics as well as many other topics. And we will be right back after these announcements from WHFR.
Thinking about going back to college but don't have anyone to care for the kids?
You're absolutely correct.
The HFCC State Licensed Child Activity Care Centers offers child care for children of HFCC students, staff, and the public.
Isn't that lovely?
The Child Activity Care Center is dedicated to providing quality care for toilet-trained children from ages 2.5 to 12 years old.
Oh, goody!
Your child is in great supervision with a child-teacher ratio of 5 to 1, which also allows for attention to be given to individual needs.
Isn't that something?
The center is open Monday through Thursday, 6:45 a.m. to 10:15 p.m. and Fridays from 6:45 a.m. to 4 p.m. Call 313-317-6527 for more information or visit HFCC's main campus at 5101 Evergreen Road, just south of Ford Road in Dearborn. The HFCC Child Activity Care Center.
Henry Ford Community College is a great way to get a valuable education at a lower cost. Visit hfcc.edu and compare for yourself. You'll see that the cost of 60 credit hours at Eastern Michigan University is $10,000 higher than the cost of 60 credit hours at Henry Ford Community College. It's $12,000 higher at Oakland University and $17,000 higher at University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Remember, we offer a four-year tuition freeze guarantee, which assures you that today's tuition rates will be frozen for students who graduate from HFCC within 4 years. Henry Ford Community College is located near the corners of Ford and Evergreen Roads. Visit hfcc.edu for more details. The choice is clear. Henry Ford Community College, your best choice, guaranteed.
Hungry?
The Skylight Cafe is convenient and offers a variety of food options to hungry students and staff.
Pizza, daily specials, sandwiches, and entrees.
How about ordering something hot off the grill?
Or if you just want a snack.
The Skylight Cafe has cookies, desserts, chips, fresh fruit, and a wide variety of beverages.
There's even a soup and salad bar. Ours are
Monday through Thursday, 7:30 a.m. to 7 p.m. and
Friday, 7:30 a.m. to 2 p.m.
The Skylight Cafe.
And we are back with the new WHFR Journal. Here we are in October 17th, 2008.
Yeah.
I'm Susan Burrell, sitting in with Ned Piggian.
They could be podcasting this in the future. We are wondering all, what day it is.
Yes, we are all volunteers here at the station, and the PSAs we just heard were all produced by our wonderful staff here at WHFR, and I want to commend the staff on the wonderful job they do on producing PSAs. They put the music together, they put the script together, and they're giving us valuable information about topics we need to know about, especially Henry Ford Community College, the Skylight Cafe, tuition rates at Henry Ford Community College are very, very reasonable and competitive, and lots of other great information. But we were talking before the break about voting and about voting issues, and Ned, I think you want to tell us about some of the candidates.
Just a couple of the major candidates that affect us around here, the federal candidates. Actually, when you were talking about the PSAs, I happened to be driving in my car the other day, and on I came. I said, gee, that sounds like me.
And Ned has done numerous...
I just think I've only done a couple or one.
Yes, you've done several good ones, and yeah. Ned has a great voice, by the way, so he's great on the radio.
Most people don't realize we don't sound like ourselves to ourselves. After a while, you get used to hearing yourself that's you, because it's completely different. Anyway, these are very, the most important in our listening area is, of course, our Congressman, Senator Levin is up for election. And all I want to say about that is you don't hear much about it, but Congressman, Senator Levin, as well as his brother Congressman, which is not in our area, are up for election. And let me see, how many are we going to read? The Senator Levin, who is seeking re-election this year, challenging the incumbent candidate on the ballot, will be the current state representative, Jack Hogan Dyke Jr. And that's the point I wanted to make. I didn't want to get into this very, the Republican challenging the Democrat is Mr. Hogan Dyke. And let's see, I'm hoping in this article to find exactly how many terms that Levin has been. My guess was three, and this would be his fourth. So he's completed three terms. He's been there for 18 years, is my guess. But the article is not making that clear. The thing you need to know, probably, is a little bit more about Mr. Hogan Dyke. And the article here that we're seeing asks him, why are you the most qualified candidate? And he answers, qualified is for the voters to decide. So true. I have 15 years of experience in sales, marketing, management, making payroll, meeting a business plan, hiring, firing, and paying the taxes, 7 years as director of a 501c3 nonprofit. So I guess he hasn't been heavy into politics, and Senator Levin is going to be very difficult to beat, and I suspect the Republican Party has asked Mr. Hogan Dyke to sacrifice himself. However, in our congressional race that affects us here in Dearborn Heights and other areas, is the Dean of the House of Representatives, who is John Dingell, is held his post for 52 years and is looking to extend that long run this November. In case you don't know, it's very interesting. He succeeded his own father in 1955. And I believe his father was the congressman in the, of course, the district always changes. So that's unusual. The person running against him is a Republican candidate, Jack Lynch. In an effort to keep readers informed about the candidates, the newspaper has a little bit about him. I'm just going to let you know that Mr. Dingell has a, I'd have to search the article and go to page 11 to see how Mr. Lynch's qualifications, because I believe that he may have something interesting to tell us, but...
Is Mr. Lynch a Republican?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Lynch is running to depose...
He's not very well known.
Well, he's going to have a hard time trying to beat Mr. Dingell, that's for sure.
Yes, because Dingell has quite a reputation, and he's a congressman.
Well, that's why I mentioned he's been the congressman for 52 years.
Yeah.
Now, the other race in our district, where in our listening audience, is the McOtter race. Four challengers in the 11th district. In case I didn't mention it, Dingell is the 15th district. Incumbent Republican. Here the incumbent's a Republican. Not in for 52 years. I don't think Mr. McOtter is 52 years old. But who currently represents the 11th district in the U.S. House of Representatives will seek to keep his seat next month, which when he faces Democratic challenger Joseph W. Larkin.
And he's not well known either.
Actually, if he is who I think he is, his wife is the chairman of the Democratic Party in the 11th District.
Oh.
I saw those signs from Mr. Larkin, but I wasn't sure whether it was Mrs. Larkin or him. I don't know him, but I'm not trying to give their biographies to let you know that these, in our listening area, we have Mr. Dingell and Mr. Lynch opposing him, and McOtter is the incumbent, and he has Mr. Larkin opposing him, and Senator Levin has Mr. Hogendyke, and I don't think you're going to see much change from the incumbents.
Well, I don't think so. I don't think so either. And I have to say I really appreciate McOtter because he voted against the big bailout. And so I was very happy that he voted against it. And, of course, the big bailout is the topic of the day. Everybody's talking about it and how is that going to fix the economy and the stock market and the fact that the banks aren't loaning any money right now and how is all that money going to be distributed. And I just want to mention Bernie Sanders is a U.S. senator. I believe he's from Vermont.
Yes.
And he's one of our few independent senators.
He's an independent.
Yeah, that's working in government. Most of them are either Democrat or Republican. And so he wrote a piece about the
He used to be the independent congressman from Vermont.
And his piece is titled Billions for Bailouts, Who Pays? And I'm going to kind of paraphrase some of the things that he says and his ideas, and I hope that Ned will jump in and comment here and there.
Oh, that's easy.
Yeah. He says
harder to read what he said.
He says, the current financial crisis facing our country has been caused by the extreme right-wing economic policies pursued by the Bush administration. These policies include huge tax breaks for the rich, unfettered free trade, and the wholesome deregulation of commerce. And it has resulted in a massive, massive redistribution of wealth from the middle class to the very wealthy.
There's not much to comment there. The guy is absolutely 1,000% right.
Well, Ned is agreeing so far. And he goes on to say that since President Bush has been in office, nearly 6 million Americans have slipped into poverty. The median family income for working Americans has declined by more than $2,000. More than 7 million Americans have lost their health insurance. Over 4 million have lost their pensions. Foreclosures are at an all-time high. We were just talking about that. And the total consumer debt has more than doubled. We have a national debt of over $9.7
trillion.
$9.7 trillion. How many zeros is that now?
Well, I'll tell you, his point is very good, but let me dramatize it this way. He forgot to mention in this same period how many more millionaires have been created.
Well, he's getting to that.
Oh, he's getting to that.
He's getting to that.
Okay.
He says Bush lowered taxes on the very rich so that they are paying lower income tax rates than teachers, police officers, or nurses. That's outrageous.
You heard what...
And he goes on, and he says the wealthiest people who have benefited from Bush's policies and are in the best position to pay for the bailout are being asked for no sacrifice at all. This is absurd. This is the most extreme example that I can recall of socialism for the rich and free enterprise for the poor.
Yes, the poor can lose, the rich can't.
So... Bernie Sanders has a number of suggestions, and so he has a number of basic principles. And he says the people who can best afford to pay and the people who have benefited most from Bush's economic policies are the people who should provide the funds for the bailout. It's immoral to ask the middle class, the people whose standard of living has declined, to pay for the bailout for the rich.
Well, if you did that...
And that's what they're doing.
Yeah, but then if you did it the other way, if you notice the Republicans always say, you people are always looking to redistribute wealth.
Well...
Of course, I'm not in favor of redistributing wealth. The important thing is the disparate share that the non-wealthy have to pay.
The disproportion. And he says specifically to pay for the bailout, which is really going to cost... up to $1 trillion, another trillion. He says the government should impose a five-year 10% surtax on income over $1 million a year for couples and over $500,000 for single taxpayers. That would raise more than $300 billion in revenue. You know, I heard another economist.
And it wouldn't even hurt him, right?
Well, telling, you know, on he was giving his analysis of the bailout, and he says the reason that we're in this mess is from deficit spending. And instead, and giving all these tax breaks to the wealthiest Americans for all these years, we're borrowing money and going into debt. And it's time for everybody to start paying their fair share of taxes, including the rich, because there's no more money to borrow from. There's no more place to go to borrow. China's not going to loan us any more money, and neither are these other countries now because of this financial crisis. So now it is up to Americans, all Americans, to pay their fair share of taxes. What does Ned say?
Well, there is a couple strange things here. You know, if the Chinese have all the money, you can't take money and keep it in a bushel or a barrel or in a... You have to invest it, and there's only one place to invest it. So the whole point is to collect this and then end up buying something of value with it cheap. But the thing I wanted to say about all this, which is really amazing to me, if anybody believes that the subprime rate problem that people got themselves into, other words, went and got mortgages, bought homes that they couldn't afford, and they're not paying, are unable to pay, and they're foreclosed, is the reason to bring down the whole economic structure of the world, because the whole world has been affected by that. Sounds, they're coming, those mortgages brought the whole world down? Those mortgages were sold? You know, they made investment instruments. This is what the average person doesn't understand. 30 years ago, you bought a house. The bank on the corner loaned you $30,000. You paid them $50,000 in payments over 20 years. They made $20,000. They held the note. That's not what these guys have been doing. These entrepreneurial investors have been selling these mortgages and putting them together, and they're ending up in your 401k as an investment on mortgages that don't have the value that should have had, so on. And these things were sold internationally on and on. But all of this can't be attributed to those. How many mortgages are we talking about? How many? How many millions of dollars could they bring down the whole economic structure of the whole world?
Well,
there's something else going on here.
Famous last words. And I've said this before. I don't know if I've said this on the new WHFR journal, but the law of gravity is very strong. What goes up must come down. And the prices of homes and real estate have been going up in the United States and actually all over the world for since what? The 1980s. So this has basically been, what, 30 years of an upward spiral and spike in real estate prices going up, 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 up. They can only go so far, Ned, because incomes have to keep up with the costs, and they have not kept up with the costs, obviously, across the board, even in Europe, because Europe is even having the same problems. So that is the basic law of gravity. What goes up must come down, and the prices are too high. People are over-leveraged. It was part of a government program that Bush initiated for working people to be able to have mortgages, buy homes. Everybody went in with no money down, with not enough income to pay. They had a fixed rate for a certain period of years, and at the end of that rate, they went into an adjustable rate. And when you have an adjustable rate, you go into balloon payments. And these people could not afford their payments. No, it isn't a big part of the market, and I agree with you. It's a small percentage of a market. But these, that got us into this.
These people selling the securities, and when they investmentize these mortgages,
it's called a derivative.
Right.
What is a derivative?
Right. And the swaps that they were talking about, but these investment bankers, these people, every time they transacted something, they made money. They made millions of dollars. Now the point to get some of this money back is to go to all those people that made all the money on these funny transactions that happened and get some of that money back. You notice they don't talk too much about that.
Well, no, it's called high finance, and very few people understand high finance and derivatives. I couldn't even tell you what the definition of a derivative is, and people have talked about them for a long time, that what are these derivatives going to do in the economy? Nobody really... Well,
they
were also selling
insurance. What they are is the swaps that they talk about were they were like selling insurance on products that didn't have any rules, regulations, and guaranteeing mortgages of which they couldn't guarantee nobody had any money in. So to stop high-flying entrepreneur capitalists to invent machinery that only made them money is crazy. I would fault a person that buys a $300,000 house and he can't afford it, believing that the housing market is constantly going to go up and he'll be able to afford it, and not realizing, I have had ARM mortgages for 7 years and 3 years, and you get out of them before the ARM changes.
Well, that's the name of the game, but the problem is a lot of people, unfortunately, did not read their contracts. They didn't understand their contracts. They just went ahead and signed their mortgage people helping them, and there wasn't honesty and disclosure. There wasn't they didn't have anybody helping them. They didn't bring an attorney to the closing. I mean, there's a lot of blame to go around. It wasn't just all one person's fault, but it was this balloon in the real estate market, just like the stock market has had balloons, bubbles.
Nothing ever comes down to where you think. I'll give you an example.
The bubble eventually bursts,
I don't think that's the case. In my case, when I bought my house in Dearborn Heights, the one I live in, I put 25% down.
Right, but people weren't doing that. That's what I'm saying.
Then I don't feel sorry for them because they were gambling and they lost. What did they lose? They didn't lose anything because they didn't put any money down, and they paid rent. Their mortgage payment, while they could pay it, was paying rent. So they lost nothing.
No, but the people who really lost were the people who started out with a fixed-rate mortgage, and then they later refinanced, and then they got into this balloon payment and they're the ones that lost.
If I've refinanced my house, my bank came to me and said, would you like to have a 5% redo your mortgage 5%? I said, well, no cost, no anything. Fine, why not?
Right, but there were hidden.
But if you're taking money out of the house, so now you don't have any equity. You might as well go to the casino with a $100 bill and put it in one of the machines and keep pulling the lever.
And that's what a lot of people were doing, too. They were taking the equity out of their homes and borrowing against it. But I think you have an article for us about GM or Chrysler. Do we have time for that?
That's another problem. It shows what's happening in the world. Here we're talking about the Dingell's history of repeating the Depression has some concern with us. We need to talk about that. But the changing... Look, we used to have three American manufacturers of automobiles, okay? We have three. Do you realize how many Japanese companies are selling cars in the United States?
Quite a few.
Well, I think it's more than three. It's Toyota, it's Honda, it's Nissan, it's Mitsubishi, it's Suzuki.
Hyundai.
Hyundai is a Korean company. Well, we're not even going in that. I think Obama said something about that that's very interesting. They are selling hundreds of thousands of cars in America and building some here, but they created plants, but they won't allow any American cars. I mean, if I was president of the United States and they were doing that, I'd just say, this game is over with. That's it. You don't let mine in? What is this? That, then yours don't come in either. What's so difficult about that? Anyway, we're getting slightly off track of the economic thing. If you think, imagine if Chrysler is taken over by General Motors, or if they buy it or they absorb it, that's one less president, that's one couple more vice president, and there's a thousand, how many plants will close, how many workers are going to lose their jobs, who do you think is going to pay their pensions? When the companies can't pay, their pension plans are dead and broke. You go into the federal pension program, which is supposed to save pension.
So who's taking over who?
The idea is that General Motors is not going to buy. They're going to just absorb it, keep probably the Jeep line, because that Cerberus, the company that bought bought Chrysler from Mercedes, who bought it, they paid $36 billion for Chrysler.
Did they overpay?
Well, they overpaid, I guess, because they sold it for $6 billion.
Oh, my goodness.
So now Cerberus is going to sell it to General Motors, or General Motors is going to absorb it for what? Probably take over the pension plan of the employees. You think General Motors is going to give them $6 billion? I don't think so. They're going to give them some. If I was negotiating that deal, I guess I'd look at it and see what it was worth. But the economic impact of what this means, and it's not what it means to Michigan. America used to be a manufacturing country.
Thank you.
If you're going to fight a war around the world, you got to have the economic base to do it. You have to be able to make things. So I guess you'll call the Japanese and ask them to make you some airplanes, and you'll call the Koreans and say, make me some trucks.
Well, if you get into a political crisis, who's going to be your friend and who's going to be your enemy? That is the question.
Well, you have to, the American people have to ask themselves, what on earth are we doing when we are the richest country in the world and everybody that has something to sell, God has to sell it to us? You can't sell it in Kenya. We have children that have more money than the average person in the world does. And this is the marketplace. So they opened up their marketplace. They destroyed the companies doing, and the companies that were the capital, the venture capitalists that are here, send their money to China so that they can take advantage of the 50 cents a day cost. That's where it is. Now we have to, now I can go to Walmart or Kmart. I can buy something for 50 cents. I don't know. What did we gain from all this? When we used to have how many automakers? If we had Packard, if we had Hudson, if we had Nash.
Well, so you're
and
saying,
if we had Studebaker, just look at the ones that we lost.
Right, but this is all because of NAFTA. This is all because of free trade.
That happened before. We could have, if we had the attitude we have today, we could have saved those companies.
So you think that the next president should get in there and revise some of our trade agreements more in favor of...
Throw them out the door.
Out the door.
Because the people need this marketplace. I like the 1950s. A car cost $3,000, and there were how many? I just named you five manufacturers that got a business, and there's three. There were eight of us. There were foreign car manufacturers. There are more foreign car manufacturers times three. I just named you six or seven Japanese. Forget the Europeans. The Italians, the French, they're not in this market. Certainly the Germans, the Swedes are. So what would be left? Why would you do such a foolish thing? How is that helpful to the average? And this is what really is amazing when it comes time to elections, that the two political parties that espouse different ideas about that, where virtually you got 40% of the people, 80% agreeing, even though they're going bankrupt. You would think 70 or 80% of the people would be for the one that says, I'm for you, and 20 or 30% would be for the people that say, no, you got to give more money to the people that have money and the corporations because they're going to give you a job in the future. You wouldn't think it would be 40-45. It should be 80-20, but it's the non-committed person.
Okay, so we do have the election coming up on November 4th, and there are very, very big, important decisions for all of us to make regarding the future of the country. So don't forget to go vote. And we're just about out of time here on the new WHFR Journal.
God.
And I just have to mention about Henry Ford Community College, because the new WHFR Journal, we are located on the campus, beautiful campus, of Henry Ford Community College.
With a brand new building.
And a brand new building, and they've been very kind to us here, and they treat us very well. And we want to mention that Henry Ford Community College is celebrating their 70 years of excellence and innovation this year during 2008-2009 academic calendar. And you can go to the website, hfcc.edu, for more information. But HFCC is the only higher education institution to carry the name and legacy of automotive pioneer Henry Ford.
From the Henry Ford Trade School.
Yes.
When it merged with the school.
We serve more than 25,000 students annually. We prepare students for a rapidly changing world and workplace by offering more than 100 degree and specialized certificate programs. And residents of the Dearborn Public School Districts receive a 46% in-district tuition discount at HFCC.
Thank God for that.
Yes, and this fall, Henry Ford Community College has seen a significant increase in enrollment, up 15% from last fall. And President Gail Mee attributes the enrollment increase to a number of factors, including lower tuition, excellent transfer options to four-year universities, small class sizes, faculty dedicated to teaching, the latest technology in classrooms and labs, and programs leading directly to employment.
And it all began in 1938 in Fortson High School with the Dearborn Junior College, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, and if you would like more information on Henry Ford Community College, call 800-585-HFCC or go to the website at hfcc.edu. And
they'll keep us on the air as well.
Yes, they'll keep us on the air. And we are out of time for today on the new WHFR Journal. I want to thank Ned Piggian for joining me here today and offering his current events and political insights. And Ned is an excellent staff member here at WHFR.
And my program is called Then and Now, How History Affects Current Events.
Yes, and so Ned has a lot of knowledge about history and historical events and how they're affecting current events. And I want to thank Jay Kornack for allowing me to sit in for him today. And again, we hope he's having a great time in Austin, Texas. And he'll tell us all about it next week when he returns. And we're going to talk about politics and the upcoming election when Jay returns, because we only have a few weeks until voting day.
Hopefully we'll get a chance to interview the Speaker of the House of the Legislature, Andy Dillon.
Well, we'll see. We'll see who we can bring in for an interview here at WHFR 89.3. We are in Dearborn, and we are making waves. And we've got to make waves right out of the studio here. And next up is going to be Joanne Korchenska with Highway 61. So I'm Susan Morell, and I thank you for joining us here today.
And she's at the door.
We're going to say goodbye for now, and Joanne will be right here with you on WHFR, the only station making waves.